joy to greet you all in the name of the Lord. The lights in the center are intentionally dimmed for the moment because I hope to finish verses 1 to 8 today. I mean, how in the world can you spend 7 weeks, is it seven, on 8 verses? We got a few more cartoons to look at, and then we'll move on to verse 9, progress today. All right, this is one of those rare moments, I've alluded to it once or twice, where archaeology actually begins to illuminate some things that are going on in the text. And so in recent years, we have had discoveries that have implications for the text we are reading here in Deuteronomy chapter 27. We've got to stop using the word Deuteronomy. It still troubles me. Second law. Ela hadavarim. These are the words. These words in chapter 27. Well, let's move right in. What do you see? A footprint. Yes, a footprint. What in the world is that doing there? This is a Badet Eshab, Manassite Jordan Valley, just down the creek, Sunset Boulevard, down Sunset Boulevard from the place we are at. Adam Zertal, an archaeologist, believed the shape symbolized Israel's claim to the land. Which is interesting, because in Deuteronomy 11:24, every place the sole of your foot treads will be yours. Your territory will extend from the wilderness to the Lebanon and from the Euphrates River to the Mediterranean. Every place where your foot steps. In fact, in Genesis chapter, 13 or 14, the Lord says to Abraham, walk back and forth, up and down the land. There's a special word there, hithalek, which Donald Wiseman argues means survey the land and stake your claim. Every place where you step is yours. And this is what they're doing. And so, this is Zertal's theory. Nobody left a plaque saying the shape of the walls of this settlement are in the shape of a foot because this is our footprint. But it's an interesting idea. And sometimes you have to be a little imaginative and creative. Here's another one. At El Unuk, Jordan Valley, just a little distance from that. Here is another one at Gilgal in Rimonim in the Jordan Valley. Footprints everywhere. Well, what's the significance of footprints? Some of you know John Munson, whose parents attend our church, who now teaches at Trinity. He has written the definitive dissertation on this site up in Syria, Ain Dara. It's a massive temple from the time of Solomon. In fact, it gives us probably better illustration of the footprint of a temple for what Solomon's footprint or the footprint of that temple might have looked like. But the interesting thing is, at the entrance to that temple, here as we work our way to the high place, there are these massive footprints in the rock. Now, you don't see from that how massive they are, but there you get an idea. Of course, that raises the question, whose footprints are those? And the theory is that these are the footprints of the deity who is hereby declaring, this is the legitimate place of worship. I live here. He has entered this place. In Deuteronomy chapter 12, Moses tells the people, you shall wipe out all the Canaanite installations and blot out the names of their gods from this land. For the Lord is choosing, will choose a place for his name to dwell. Well, that has reference to the temple, but in any case, here we've got some interesting things. Now we're at Mount Ebal. This is not Gerizim. This is Ebal across the valley from Mount Gerizim, where in Jesus' day, New Testament times, there was the Samaritan temple. But on the other side of the valley, there is this installation. And if Don Maltz were here, he would say, more rocks. I was so disappointed 2 years ago when we went to Israel. We couldn't go here. We could go to Gerizim on the other side of the valley, but this is not safe territory. And I wanted our agent guide to arrange for a cab up there. We know that if a bus would go, you'd get pelted, but a cab, or we could go. I so wanted to go to this pilgrimage site for me, because if you've worked in Deuteronomy, Ebal is really important. We saw it from a distance. Here's an artist's reconstruction, and again, you see the footprint kind of shape, a bit of it, with the altar up. Or is that an altar? What is this thing? There have been all sorts of theories. Zertal, who was the first to publish it, he proposed that this site was the altar of Joshua 8:30. We've referred to that text repeatedly, where Joshua fulfills what Moses is prescribing here. He builds the altar and he writes down the Torah on these pillars, and that's the fulfillment of this in Joshua 8:30. Zertal said, this is that place. Of course, there are lots of skeptics around. Immediately, Aaron Kempinski responded, oh, it's just a watchtower. And then Bill Deaver, an American archaeologist, jokingly dismissed it as a barbecue site. Why is it a barbecue site? Because they found all kinds of bones here of stuff people had eaten. Well, here are some images of where we are. It is just north of Shechem from a distance. More rocks. I mean, this is the land of milk and honey. What was Moses smoking in chapter 8 when he has this ode to the land? Who wants to live there? It's like Saskatchewan. Why would you live there? But in any case, it is the promised land. It's home. That's why it's important. Well, here is a view. You can see from this, the reason I have this one is the size of the thing. It's massive. This is a reconstruction of what it may have looked like. What is this site? And of course, there's no plaque there that tells us what the significance of it is. So archaeologists, my friend Ralph Hawkins has recently, he can't go there anymore, but about 10 years ago, he was able to go there and he wrote his entire dissertation on this site. And so he himself can't go there, but he sent me some of these pictures to use here. And here are part of his observations. There are more than 50 installations here containing animal bones, ashes, pottery. The special nature of these bones is curious. They are the kinds of bones that you use in sacrifices. It's an isolated site on a prominent mountain. Corners of the main structure are oriented toward the compass. It's very deliberately structured, and the architecture is that of a significant one. They found these pots there and even a Mount Ebal dice. Somebody threw a 5. They found plaster here. No inscriptions, but there are remains of plaster. Pottery containing bones of ritually clean animals. Interestingly, no donkeys, no horses, no pigs. No carnivore bones. And of course, I wish we had Daniel Master here. He would explain the significance of this. This is one of the most, the clearest ways of identifying a site as Israelite rather than Canaanite. So, bone fragments are very important. Digging up bones. That's what they're looking. I'm looking for texts. Those guys are looking for bones. And so, no donkeys, horses, which reminds us that, this may in fact have been a sacred place. But we have to remind ourselves that according to Deuteronomy chapter 12, it needn't necessarily have been a worship place. Maybe they just came for a banquet. Because in chapter 12, Moses authorizes the people, if you want to eat meat, other than three times a year at the festival at the central sanctuary, you say, I'd like to eat meat at in my home. Go ahead, eat meat. But be sure it's kosher meat and kosher cooked. Go ahead and eat meat. So it could, but in a sense, then I think we have to suggest that every meal is a sacrifice. The proportion of remains from the four parts of the animal is higher at Ebal than any other Iron Age I sites. What's the significance of that? May possibly be associated with Exodus 29 and Leviticus 7, where the Israelites are commanded to sacrifice the right foreleg of the animal and give the right hind leg to the priests. Oh. So that may not be so accidental that it is the four legs, F-O-R-E, not F-O-U-R, the four legs that show up here because the priests have had their perks and they've gone home and they've cooked them at home. Here's a reconstruction of this ramp kind of structure with a hearth of sorts on each side, but... The interesting thing is there. This thing is made of uncut stones. Remember our conversation? No chisel touched these stones. They are uncut. It fits that one. This is a drawing of the first century BC altar from the Jerusalem temple based on rabbinic work. And so you can see the parallel here. The interesting thing is Exodus chapter 20 at the end says, when you build an altar, don't build steps. Build a ramp. Why wouldn't you build steps? Of course, it has to do with exposing the undergarments of the priests who are walking up there. So my guess is this is an allusion to something like that. Well, here you get an idea of the size of the altar. We tend to think these altars were all small. Those of us who have been to the to Beersheba, that's a fairly massive one. I mean, like this. But look at this one. Solomon's temple. Ah, not Solomon's temple. David's temple. Solomon was just a gopher. You never talk about Bezalel's tabernacle. Who received, who directed the construction of the tabernacle? Moses. The tabernacle of Moses. Moses, David is to the temple what Moses is to the tabernacle. Solomon is to the temple what Bezalel is. David got the blueprint from God. It was David's idea. He gathered, in any case, notice how big the altar was for the temple. 16 feet across, and 16 feet high, 32 by 32 feet. That's massive. You can sacrifice a lot of animals at once on that thing. Ezekiel's visionary temple, I've worked a little bit with this one, 5 feet high. This one is 29 by 29 feet. This one is the Mount Ebal altar that they have discovered is 30 feet by 23 feet. So it all fits the picture. Some of us have been to Megiddo. You remember this round altar? This is not from Israelite times, it's Bronze Age. But that big round altar is 15 feet across. So it is a massive thing. But the dimensions fit what we're talking about. But of course, when you discover stuff like this, the question always is, from which period are they? What's the date? How can you tell? Well, we do carbon 14 dating, we do all kinds of other things, dendrochronology. You look at the trees. Here's an interesting thing. A scarab from the time of Ramses II that they found there. Really? It displays a geometrical pattern consisting of a four-petal rosette, and between the petals, four branches. Out of each branch comes an Egyptian cobra. These are very rare. Only five of these have been found. But here are the dates, 1279 to 1213. Oops. Guess what? It almost fits. It almost fits. By some people's dating, it fits exactly. So, now, of course, we do know that in the book of Joshua, there are two assemblies at this meeting, at this place. There is an assembly in chapter 8 before they launch the campaign. And then at the end of the book, before Joshua leaves the scene, he gathers the people to Shechem one more time. There's no reference to this altar, but there is a reference to Shechem, which is right here. He gathers them one more time, and that's where he says, and we heard it in the sermon this morning, choose you this day whom you will serve. That's Joshua talking. At the covenant renewal ceremony before he leaves so that he can go to his grave in peace, I guess. He's done his job, and not one of the Lord's promises failed. He did what he was supposed to. This may be maybe evidence for the date of the Exodus somehow or other. That doesn't mean that the bones they found and the scarab come from when the altar was built. They may have had other gatherings at this place. And just because the Bible mentions only two doesn't mean there are only two. But this does suggest that in the early 13th century, at least, there was a big gathering here, and somebody brought along a seal of the Egyptians, and he dropped it. We don't know what happened. One more image here, and this is the picture of the Levitical towns. Remember, they're supposed to identify 48 Levitical towns from which the Levitical priests were to go out and do their pastoral ministry. It's kind of, a cathedral system where you've got the central sanctuary, then you've got the Levitical towns, and then from the Levitical towns, the Levitical priests would go out and teach Torah, lead the people in community worship of whatever sort, and in any case. But notice where Shechem is one of those Levitical towns. It's not only a Levitical town, but if you're close enough to see, you can see some of these have squares. There are, I think, it's supposed to be six of them. Those are asylum towns. We usually call them cities of refuge, but I prefer the word asylum towns, where if you cause an accidental death for somebody and the kinsman redeemer is after you to take your life, on the assumption it's murder, then Shechem is one of those asylum towns where people, very significant place is Shechem. But you also see from this, it is dead center. Right in the middle, a very significant place. Well, of course, that's where they're headed, off to Ebal. That's where they should have gone, and that's where they're headed. Anyhow, I'm done the geography. Any questions? Yes, ma'am.
Is there any reason, maybe you've already said this, but is there some reason why they didn't choose Shechem as opposed to Jerusalem?
The question is there any reason why the Lord didn't, stated reason why the Lord didn't choose Shechem as his central sanctuary as opposed to Jerusalem? The answer to that one is no. We don't know. There is no stated reason. You have hints of the significance of Jerusalem already in Genesis. Melchizedek, king of Salem, is there. Mount Moriah, where Abraham sacrifices Isaac, is in Jerusalem. So there are, and I think the reason why those stories are in Genesis, because from the point of view of history, those places are significant. But there's no signal yet to Abraham that on Mount Moriah you are to sacrifice him, because this is going to be a very significant place in the future. And actually, when David purchases this land, he buys it from a Canaanite priest. It's a land transaction. Who'd have thunk? That's how it works. But he must have known, David. I have a feeling the Lord told David, this is the land. This is what you are to purchase. So that now the king and the spot and the Ark of the Covenant will all be together in one place. But the answer is, we alluded to this earlier. If I had been designing stuff, I'd have made this the site of the temple. Ebal is the highest place in the country, whatever. But no. Maybe this is Deuteronomy 29:39, which our pastor quoted, the secret things belong to the Lord. But the Torah is revealed clearly to everybody. Those are not the secrets. There's no mystery in the will of God for his people. But there are lots of mysteries on why and how God makes his decisions. Yes, sir.
While you have the map up, do you have an idea of where that the giant witness altar that was built by the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh was?
This is a clear one. But that was after, this is Joshua chapter 22. We don't know the correlation between the last gathering at Shechem and here. But if that, the biblical events aren't always told in chronological order. My guess is that after the conquest was over, they regathered at this place, and then he sent Reuben, Gad, and the half of Manasseh back home, and they will have come back down this valley. And I imagine they crossed the Jordan about here. So that massive altar would have been somewhere here in the Jordan Valley, somewhere there. That's my best guess. Joshua 22, very interesting. How quickly the consciences of the 2.5 tribes who wanted the land on the other side started to bother them. We are, in fact, second-rate citizens, because that was not originally part of the promised land. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Jerusalem is not in that scheme of Levitical towns and that temple.
No, Jerusalem is not. Where are we? Jerusalem should be up here. No, Jerusalem's not in that. Somewhere where I've actually published this, at the bottom of this map, I've got a listing of all of them. And no, Jerusalem's not in there, which is really remarkable.
Your accessibility of Moriah versus Ebal would be one consideration. And number two, the prominence of Judah as the one who led the tribes and did most things. Would that be in his territory?
The question is, would the accessibility of Moriah to Abraham from Beersheba, it wouldn't have been, this is right in the middle in terms of access. The people from up here, this would be more accessible than coming all the way down here.
But why
Yeah, but there, you climb the mountain once, and then there's a main road that runs right across the ridge at the top. So that once you've climbed the mountain to Jerusalem, you're already up on the highlands, and it's not a difficult thing. What was the second part of your question? Judah's leadership. That's an interesting, except when you see where the tribal territories are specified, Jebus, and the people of Jerusalem were Jebusites, is in Benjamin. Which is really curious. It is virtually on the border, but where specified, Jebus is Benjamite. And so, actually, I think what happens is when David conquers what is the city of David, Jerusalem, it could be that the boundary actually runs right through, and it is on the border. Anyway, what else? Any other curiosities I can't answer? Yes, that Megiddo altar, let's go way back. Where was this one? There's not a ramp, but there are stairs here. Recessed, exactly. But this is Canaanite. This is not Israelite. This is Canaanite. Did they have the same kind of sensitivities? We don't actually know. All right. Yes, ma'am. Of? Oh, is there a verse that says God granted their request but sent leanness to their soul? I recognize the reference says, but I don't know where it's located that you're talking about. When you read, and we, oh my goodness, 6 years ago when we were at the end of chapter 3, we talked about this. And read, if you read Deuteronomy and you read Numbers, there are serious questions about the legitimacy of the request. In Deuteronomy, Moses says, I gave you permission to stay on this side. So should he have done that? Did he speak too quickly? I don't know, but it is curious that part is never part of the predicted promised land.
So
we need to be careful what we ask. And the other thing is sometimes God answers yes to our prayers to our hurt. He says, go ahead, let the baby have the nook. God does that.
Could God's choice of Jerusalem or Salem be tied in maybe his desire to focus on obedience is better than sacrifice? In the sense that the historical things in Genesis are all examples of obedience as opposed to the altar and the sacrifice and ultimately Christ coming through perfectly.
The question is, could the choice of Jerusalem over Shechem be related to the biblical principle of obedience is better than sacrifice? I don't know. My guess is that the theology would have applied to this place as well. We do know that Genesis 22 story is an amazing statement of obedience. The Lord tested Abraham. And it's an awful test. Put yourself in his shoes. And what does Abraham do? Fine. That's the Lord's problem. And he goes out and he does it. Now, I wouldn't put these two in opposition to each other. But of course, long range. Jesus dies on this place so that we know in the scheme of things, the axis, the link between heaven and earth is actually Zion. It is Jerusalem. But then why does God play around with Shechem? But you begin to understand now, perhaps, that John text, Jesus says in the old King James, I must needs go through Samaria. Why did he feel a compulsion to go through Samaria? And he lands up at the Jacob's well and he runs into the Samaritan woman, and this becomes a great moment of gospel, pointing people away from this place, Gerizim now, as I said earlier in the Samaritan Pentateuch, they read Gerizim here too, pointing people away from this place to the other place. Well, actually he says, neither Jerusalem nor Shechem, but in spirit and in truth, as if that's a place, an interesting place. All right, I think we're done. We can have the lights. If you can turn up the lights now. Some people are trying to fill out their forms and they can't see. All right, done with verse 8. Let's go to verses, the rest of the chapter. And now I have to remind ourselves of the structure of this chapter. It divides into three parts. The future dramatic ritual. What are they going to do at Mount Ebal? Then the present challenge, and then a future verbal ritual. It's as if these two verses are the fulcrum on which this, we used to call them teeter-totters, or seesaw. I don't know why they called it that. But it's as if these two verses are the fulcrum on which that hangs. That's the structure of this. You can put it in print something like this: commemorating the basis of Israel's claim to the land, verses 1 to 8. B, challenging the people to wholehearted devotion to the Lord today. Then C, securing the devotion of the people of the Lord for tomorrow. And that part will divide into two parts: corporate blessing and curse ritual, and then the individual curse ritual, which Daniel dealt with a couple of weeks ago. So let's read our text of this morning. Then Moses and the Levitical priests spoke to all Israel, saying, shh, haskait. That's the Hebrew. You just learned some Hebrew. Shut up. Be quiet and listen, O Israel. This very day you have become the people of the Lord your God. So listen to the voice of the Lord your God, fulfilling his commands and his ordinances that I am commanding you today. Four or five observations on this text. One, notice the speakers. Moses and the Levites are talking. At the beginning, we had Moses, I think, and the elders. Now it's Moses and the Levites. Moses is already setting the stage for his departure. Here he's up front with the Levites. Together they are talking. Once he is gone, the Levites have to take over. But in a sense, this is authenticating them. The interesting thing is, if we go back to what he said, look at verse 10. So listen to the voice of the Lord your God, fulfilling his commands that I am command. Oh yeah, guess who's talking? Moses. It is still Moses' voice that the Levites participate in. So, the speakers. The timing. This very day. We've just been talking about tomorrow. And he'll come back to tomorrow. But now he brings the people back. Today, today. Let's talk about the significance of what has happened today. at this moment, never mind tomorrow. And then he has this call to attention. Be quiet and listen, O Israel. This expression for be quiet occurs only here in the entire Old Testament. Shh. Now, of course, why would you want to be quiet? This may be part of the picture that we saw. You are to build an altar with uncut stones so that you don't hear the sound of the chisel. And you are to write on plaster the text so that you don't hear the sound of the chisel. It may be a part of that, but after this, when we get to verses 13 and on, it becomes a very loud thing. So for the moment, we're being quiet. It's part of the, shh, think about it. But why else would you be quiet? Anybody, was anybody in the service this morning? Was anybody awake in the service this morning? Why would you be quiet? What did our pastor say? He made a passing allusion, setting us up. He's the warm-up band. What did he say about being silent? He used the word speechless. Speechless. Think about it. Today, what's happened? And then he announces, look what's happened. Today, we have become the people of the Lord. Really. This is, in summary form, the significance of the whole book of Deuteronomy for that generation. That's what has happened. You see, these people, most of them, weren't at Sinai. And the ones that were there at Sinai were too young to give their signatures. What Moses is hereby saying is, that's the significance of what's been going on since chapter 1, verse 1. Which helps me understand why he says, be quiet. Think about it. Wow! I can't believe this! How did this happen? Who are we that God should have called us to be his people? Again, the secret things belong to the Lord. That's the mystery. Think about it. Shh, listen, Israel. Today we have become the people of God. And of course, you notice that's a kind of a passive thing. It doesn't say, today we have made ourselves the people of God. Who made them the people of God? Well, let's look at a couple of texts. Chapter 28, verse 9. We'll get there next year. The Lord will establish you. Who's the subject of the verb? The Lord. This is that hakim. The expression for making a covenant is usually to cut a covenant. But when you confirm, establish a covenant, this is usually the word. The Lord will establish you as a people holy to himself, as he has sworn to you, if you keep the commands of the Lord your God and walk. Oh, this is an important reminder, isn't it? This isn't automatic entitlement. There's the if. This is where, again, the pastor alluded to, there are two sides to this equation. There's what God has done, and there is what we do in this case in response. If you don't respond this, you're not in on the game. But this is this is, the Lord will establish you. And then 29:9-12. All of you are standing today before the Lord your God, your leaders, your tribes, your leaders, tribes, elders, officials, all the men of Israel, your children, your wives, the foreigners in your camps who cut your wood and draw your water, so that you may enter the covenant of the Lord your God. This covenant is never called Israel's covenant. It's always the Lord's covenant with Israel. It's never Israel's covenant with God. It's always His with them. It's the Lord your God is making, Karath, with you today so that you may enter into His oath. And that is the oath that God swears a fidelity to it. By entering in, you come under that. And so He may establish you today as His people, and that He may be your God. Guess what? As He promised you, and as He swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That happened already at Sinai. You have the same word, Hakim. At Sinai, the Lord established the covenant with Israel, who came out of Egypt, that He had first made with Abraham. Now this generation is in on that. Let's go back to that Genesis text. This is very important for understanding the significance of Deuteronomy, the significance of the footprint. I hope that image sticks in your mind now for a while. Genesis 17. As for me, my covenant is with you. Who's talking? Not Abraham. Abraham does not say to God, as for me, my covenant is with you. No. God said, my covenant is with you. You will become the father of many nations. Your name will no longer be Avram, but your name will be Avraham, for I will make you the father of many nations, and I will make you extremely fruitful, make nations and kings come from you, and I will establish my covenant. Here's that word, Hakim. He has made it with Abraham. He will establish it, confirm it with his descendants. My covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations as an everlasting covenant, Brit Olam, I actually think it means irrevocable covenant. Ad Olam, Brit Olam, to be your God, and guess who else is God? The God of your offspring after you. Ad Olam, irrevocable. Now, there's one more sentence. And to you and your offspring after you, I will give the land where you are residing, all the land of Canaan, as an eternal, irrevocable possession, and I will be their God. We have a tendency, this is an aside now, we have a tendency to distinguish between the Abrahamic covenant and the Israelite covenant. We call the Abrahamic covenant unconditional covenant of grace and an eternal covenant. The Israelite, you call it the Mosaic or the Sinai covenant. I don't. Why not? All the other covenants are identified by the party whom God calls to be His covenant partner. God's covenant with David, God's covenant with Abraham. Well, then why don't we do it here? This covenant is not with Moses, and it's not with Sinai. So why would we call it that? So I call it the Israelite covenant. So the Abrahamic covenant, supposedly irrevocable, eternal, and unconditional. The Sinai covenant, Israelite covenant, is temporal and conditional covenant of obligation. That's what you have in the scholarly literature, a covenant of grace or a covenant of gift and a grant and a covenant of obligation. As far as I'm concerned, that's totally wrong. It's one and the same. When God makes the covenant with, confirms the covenant with Israel at Sinai, He ordains them to the mission to which He called Abraham. That's the calling. So that, to me, there are concentric circles. That's the seed of the big thing. Which is why in Genesis, repeatedly, you get this curious thing that Abraham is faithful to the, you call it, Sinai covenant. Genesis 26, verse 5 and 6. Because Abraham kept my statutes, my ordinances, my laws. What statutes, ordinances, and laws did Abraham have? Sounds like what was revealed at Sinai to me and preached in Deuteronomy. He had one ordinance, circumcision. And yet Deuteronomy says nothing, not a lick, about physical circumcision. It talks about spiritual, but not physical. So, in my view, these are the things. What's happened here is now this generation of Israel are wrapped into the Abrahamic covenant, and it's on that basis they have the right to cross over the Jordan and claim the land. And it's on that basis that we now recognize their mission. In you shall all the nations of the world be blessed. At the end of chapter 26, we saw, see, I've set you high above the nations for praise, for fame, and for glory. That's the calling. It's not about Israel. It's about the light they are to reflect through the whole world, so that what happens in this land under Israel becomes a microcosm of what the world is supposed to be and what Eden was. So that's how this is. So what's happening here is the fulfillment, which then leads to the charge. Oh, here's the mission, Abraham's mission. So listen to the voice of the Lord your God, fulfilling His commands and ordinances that I am commanding you today. Hey, the fulfillment of the mission depends upon faithfulness. The call to covenant relationship apparently is unconditional. God didn't say, if you measure up to this standard, I'll make my covenant with you. No. He called them out of Egypt by grace alone. Totally by grace. He called them to Sinai, totally by grace, but having entered into relationship, see, I have brought you to myself. Now then, if you will keep my covenant, listen to my voice, you will be my special treasure, my royal priesthood, my holy nation, for all the earth is mine. That's what's happened here. The problem with Israel is they forget the mission, and they start to think it's all about us. And entitlement issues take over rather than privilege. So much for verses 9 and 10. Amazing. Any questions? Yes, sir.
Your propensity to count things.
Yes.
How many times does the word obedience occur connected?
The question is, with my propensity to count things, I'm a mathematician. No, I'm not really. I'm a bad mathematician. How many times does the word obedience show up in Deuteronomy? In Moses, it's very often. But you will notice that the call to obedience is always in response to a declaration of the gospel. We had it in chapter 4, verse 32 to 40. Do exhaustive research and see if anything has ever been done for another people like the Lord has done for you, that you may know that I am the Lord, there is no other. And then at the end of that little sermon, he says, so keep the commands of the Lord and do His will. And so you have it here too. So this is always response to gospel. It's never obedience first. It's always response to the grace. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
But in Deuteronomy 3:9, it says, so that you may enter the covenant.
So that you may enter into. Now, of course, that raises, there are lots of expressions we have for how this covenant is established, confirmed, whatever. So that you may enter into the covenant. I think that's actually shorthand. So that you may enter into the joys of covenant relationship. I think that's actually what it means. You may celebrate all that comes with the covenant. I think that's part of it here. Any other questions? All right. I think we'll leave the rest for tomorrow. In my books, tomorrow is always the next time we meet. And of course, you can use any words you want, so long as you define them. And so that's my definition. And as we are reminded, tomorrow for us is in a fortnight, 2 weeks from today. No class next week. Let's pray before we go. Oh, Heavenly Father, shut our mouths and open our ears that we might hear today. You have become the people of God. We thank you for the blood of the covenant shed by Jesus as we anticipate the darkness of this week, especially Good Friday. Jesus said, "This is my blood shed for you for the remission of sins, but also the blood of the covenant." Through the work of Christ, relationship with God for Israel was possible. Think about it. Is this that great secret? The hidden things belong to the Lord. Through the blood of the covenant, we too participate in that great gospel. Thank you for the grace. Inspire us to serve you. Live for you, that the world may see what grace can do. And the more graceless our culture becomes, the greater the opportunity to be the light to the world. Energize us by your Spirit. Cleanse us by your Word. For the glory of the name of the risen Christ, we ask it. Amen. Amen. Go in shalom. May God be with you.